American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And the big news this week is that the NSA chief has acknowledged that China can bring down our power grid.
Yeah, that was a
That doesn't sound good. I'll talk about how that's done. Actually, how easy it is to get into these SCADA devices, S-C-A-D-A devices. Carriers are tracking all your surfing using what they call super cookies.
And they're not tasty, but they're
tasty.
They're super cookies.
And you can't get rid of them. Qualcomm is the company behind mobile. You don't see them out in the front, but all the chips that are being made in our cell phones, the bulk of them are made by Qualcomm. Not just the radios for CDMA, but lots and lots of the chips. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about food science.
Oh, good.
A small section on food science, how to avoid lumpy gravy. Because we're coming up close to Thanksgiving. So what is the science behind the lumps in
news
the gravy?
You can use. I was thinking you're going to say how you can avoid trichinosis, but that's an
no. We're going to feature, by the way, the father of Bluetooth.
Okay, good.
He's from Sweden, and of course, it was a huge mailbag.
Giant.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Okay, here we go.
Okay. Nicely done.
Yeah,
and he helped you with it this week.
Yeah, that's a little.
It's getting
heavier and heavier. We got an email from Azra in Fredericksburg. Dear Doc and Jim, I recently upgraded my phone to iPhone 6 Plus. Woo! It's nice. Mm-hmm. After transferring my data using iCloud, I have many, many duplicate contacts. Is there any way to get rid of these duplicates? Enjoy the show, Azra in Fredericksburg. Well, Azra, this is a common problem.
Yes.
Now, the easiest way is to limit the source of the contacts in your contact manager. You see, it consolidates all the contacts from various sources. You might have a Yahoo account. You might have a Facebook account. You might have an Outlook account. You might have an iCloud account. You might have a Gmail account. And it just pulls all these guys together and displays all your contacts. Chances are you got the same contact in multiple databases. So what I do is I deselect some of these sources. So I go into the contact manager, and you can pick the sources, and I just deselect some of them until I get rid of the duplicates. That's typically what is happening. So in my case, I just pick my Outlook contacts because Outlook is my main email account, and nearly everybody I talk to is in Outlook. So I just have my Outlook one, and I might add Gmail, but not often, and that gets rid of my duplicates. Now there is, though, a case where people, if they go from other cell phones and they move their contacts around, it is possible that these duplicate contacts all get dumped into the same database. So this deselection process just does not work. So how do you merge contacts? I mean, suppose you got a whole bunch of duplicate contacts in the same database. You can't deselect it. How do you merge them? So maybe you got the phone number in one and you've got the address in another one, but it's the same person.
Right.
So you want to merge them together. The good news is there's an application that got very good reviews. It's called, get this, Cleanup Duplicate Contacts.
How straightforward could that
That's
be?
That's right. You just search for that in your app store there and download it. It's a free version, but here's the deal. Mm-hmm. It's a free version that works, but there's a lot of manual work with it. If you want to get the pro version that does a lot of the stuff in an automated way, you've got to spring for 99 cents.
Oh, man.
That's rough. And so this got this particular, I mean, this was reviewed by 1,200 people. I haven't used it, but it got great reviews. But some people didn't configure it right, and they said it totally messed up their contacts. But what it does before you actually merge the contacts, it backs up your contact database. Mm-hmm. So if you screw it up because you set it up wrong, you can just restore the backup.
Well, that's good.
So you do have several options. I'm thinking the deselection is your way to go, since you just went from one cell phone to another and you didn't change brands. We got an email.
Well, you know, it's funny. Sorry to interject, but I've wondered how that happened all along in the first place, and now you've explained that.
Yeah. Especially
it's drawing from multiple sources.
And especially you pull in iCloud contacts, and iCloud sucks in a lot of contacts, and then it dumps. So I deselect the iCloud contacts every time. Yeah.
Cool.
So we got an email from Arnie McKechnie. He's one of our regular listeners. Hi, Dr. Schertz. Here's a little historical note. Windows 1.0 was released November 20th, 1985. This is kind of the Windows, birthday.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that was how things have progressed in 29 years. Can you imagine Windows 1.0 came out 29 years
That's
ago?
That's scary.
Yeah, I'm feeling like, came out, maybe a couple years ago. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't seem like 29 years.
Just another thing to make us feel old.
I know. Well, Arnie, thanks for that ride down memory lane. I can still recall those days. I mean, I was actually stuck with DOS at the time because Windows 1.0, Arnie, as you remember, just sucked. So did Windows 2.0, and so did Windows 3.0. I didn't switch to Windows until Windows 3.1, and that was the first one that I thought was really worth using. And then I, migrated from DOS to Windows. Mm-hmm. I think Windows 3.1 is the first primetime version for Windows. But even then, Windows 3.1 was only a 16-bit operating system. They didn't come out with a 32-bit operating system until Windows 95, which was 10 years later. And you sort of think, now you go back and remember the PC versus Mac war. Macintosh had a 32-bit operating system right out of the chute. They were so much more advanced than Windows, yet they lost, at that time, the big battle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting to go back and think of these things. Thanks for that email, Arnie. We got an email from Margaret. Dear Dr. Schertz, I'm interviewing next week for a business analyst position. I'll be focused on gathering and writing requirements for mobile apps. I've never focused on a mobile app before, so I hope you can please offer some insight on the unique aspects of this kind of requirement writing. They know I'm not a developer, and I will not be doing coding. Thanks, Dr. Schertz. Margaret. Well, I took a look at the job description. She didn't want me to actually, read the job description
sure.
on the air because it was very specific to that job.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, after reading the job description, it's pretty clear that you're going to have to use, the app is going to be drawing from data from an application running on the cloud. I won't say specifically which one it was. So you have to understand the functionality of that data so you can really articulate what the requirements are in terms of the fields that you'd have to be drawing on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and then you have to communicate those succinctly to the developers. Now, a business analyst has got to be able to listen to the customers, and usually the customer cannot articulate what they want very clearly because they don't understand how the data is structured, they don't understand the database, they don't understand what can be done, and they have these sort of generic comments. You have to listen to them and try to extract from that real requirements that developers can use. It requires good listening skills. Now, the role of a business analyst is defined as really an intermediary, which is managing the interests and needs of the project management and the IT community, sort of bring them together. Now you must work with a logical framework to conduct these activities throughout the various phases. Usually you support all aspects of mobile application development from start to finish, with particular emphasis on requirements regarding project quality, project timeline, project cost. Now, at Stratford, we've got software engineering master's degree, and a lot of our master's students out of the software engineering, their entry-level job into the tech world is as a business analyst because they understand coding. They actually would like to be a developer, but they start out as business analysts, and that prepares them to be developers when they understand the business needs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe if you're going to want to be competitive for this position, you're going to have to take a course. I just don't think you can wish yourself to be a business analyst for mobile apps. So I went and looked. I Googled free online business analyst courses. And I came up with a listing of them, and I'm going to have the link here. I'll give you the link on the web. I'll post it to the web. But you could just Google free online business analyst courses. And there are some excellent links there and some excellent background material on the structure that you have to use to be a business analyst and how you get the data, how you organize it. I think you've got to go through these courses if you want to be competitive for a business analyst position. I was looking at it. You could probably spend a day or two on these, and you'd be conversant to when you have your interview. It requires good communication, good listening, and good synthesis skills. So if that's your core trait, you could get on the structure, the business analyst structure. You could sort of learn that, and your core strengths will come shining through. We got an email from Philip in Kansas. Dear Tech Talk, my Outlook.com is putting legitimate emails into the junk mail folder. Now, it seems random. Some of my closest friends' emails are going to the junk mail folder, as well as some legitimate contacts. Can I just not use Outlook.com? Do I need it? How do I stop filtering legitimate emails? Enjoy the show. Enjoy the podcast. Oh, he's a podcast listener.
There you go.
Yeah, Philip in Kansas. Well, I mean, you could turn off all the junk mail features of Outlook.com, and then all the junk mail would just stay in your inbox. That's probably a bad idea, given the amount of junk mail that comes in. I don't think you want to become a manual junk mail filter. I mean,
no.
it increases the amount of work.
It's amazing when you go and look at your junk mail how much there really is.
I know. And so what you have to do is you have to train your spam filter. You've got to train the spam filter so it knows what to look for in your account. So what you do is you go through the account, you find an email from a friend that should not be junk, you tell Outlook.com, you say, this is not junk. And you go through everything, you say, this is not junk, this is not junk. And you keep doing this training, this is not junk training.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually, they're going to realize that in your case, for instance, like you just might love to get spam emails on antique cars. And say, normally those are going to the junk mail. But since you say anything with an antique car, you say is not spam, eventually you're going to train it to say, okay, it's antique cars. We think for everybody else it's spam. But for you, I'm going to put it in your inbox. So you can train it like that. Now, you can also set up safe senders, which I think is probably your best option. You have specific people with specific email addresses. So you can go into Outlook.com, you can click Options, and there is a menu called Safe and Blocked Senders. So you can actually put in the email addresses of your friends, and you declare them as safe senders, and their emails will never, ever again go into spam. That's a very good idea. I don't really use the block sender stuff very much, because if you're trying to use that to block spam, because these spam operators, they change the email address all the time, the from email address all the time, so you can't really block spam using that. But the safe sender block is an excellent way to keep all your friends in your inbox and properly organized. We got an email from Tung in Ohio.
Here we go.
I have a new Mac computer, and it uses a Bluetooth mouse. I can't seem to connect my Bluetooth speaker at the same time. Now, I'm listening to some audio files that my sister sent to me, and I want to listen to these audio files using the Bluetooth speaker. Now, does Bluetooth allow two devices to be connected at the same time, or do I have to disconnect the mouse before I can hook up the speaker? Because I've got the mouse on, I've got the Bluetooth mouse going, but then I can't get the speaker attached. So what's going on? Please help me. Love the show. Tung. Okay, those must be really interesting audio files if they're coming into Ohio. Okay, I don't know what's going on there, but we're going to try to help.
Usually with these guys, it's nothing good.
It's nothing good, no. So she wasn't too particular on that, but I know there's something fishy going on with those audio files. Well, a single Bluetooth device can communicate with up to 8 different devices. So actually, your Mac can communicate with 8 different devices that are within a 30-foot radius. So you can certainly connect to 2 items. Now, what it does, Bluetooth uses spread spectrum, and it has basically 92 channels, and it shifts channels or looks for different channels every 1,600 times a second. This is called frequency hopping, and so it jumps all around. And so each of these devices is operating on different channels within those 92 channels. It just they'll pick up as many channels as they need, and so they you can support eight of them with your with your 98 or 99 channels. Mm-hmm. So there's no problem. Now, what's probably happening with your Bluetooth speaker is that you probably attach your Bluetooth speaker to your iPhone. And so as soon as you turn on the Bluetooth speaker, it immediately locks onto the iPhone.
Right.
So then when you
right.
try to connect it to your Mac, it won't connect
exactly.
because it's already connected. So what you have to do is, in that case, and I've had to, because you really
yes.
can't pick it. I turn off the Bluetooth connection on my iPhone, and then I get it.
Because I have different things that want to go to the same Bluetooth speaker.
Yep.
And the one that generally goes there, if I decide to listen on something else, I'm like, why won't, it's because it's connected to this other thing.
That's right. You've experienced the same uh-huh. thing, too. So that was a good question, because I think many people wonder about that, and Bluetooth technology is a great idea.
In fact,
this email inspired me to make on our profile on IT the father of Bluetooth.
Well, that's good, and yeah. we're going to talk about that a little bit later.
Yes, indeed. We love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu.
It is Saturday morning, and you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Stand by, more of the show coming up right after this.
Innovation in IT degrees, it's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom. Right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn by doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Jacobus Cornelius Hartson. Jacobus Cornelius Hartson. That's what his mom called him.
Well, because it just rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah, that's right. Now when he started working, he didn't want people to call him Jacobus Cornelius, so they call him Jap. J-A-A-P. What do you think? Jape?
Jap. Jap looks about right, but I don't know where you get that from.
I don't
Except
know.
Except for the J and the A part.
I don't know where he came. That's kind of a nickname. I couldn't really find out where that name came from. So Jacobus Cornelius Hartson is a Dutch electrical engineer and best known as father of Bluetooth communications. Now, Jap, as his friends called him, was born 13 February 1963 in The Hague, Netherlands. Now, that's quite a nice location, The Hague, Netherlands. That's where the International Court is located. In 1986, he received an MSEE, Master of Science in Electrical Engineering, with honors from Delft University of Technology. And then he decided to go work for a while, and he worked briefly for Siemens in The Hague, and then he worked briefly for Philips in Eindhoven there. But then he decided, I better go back to school. So he headed back to school the next year to work on his PhD. And in 1990, he received a PhD in electrical engineering from Delft University of Technology, again with honors, and his thesis dealt with the design of programmable filters in silicon surface acoustic wave devices. Those are analog processing devices that were very popular and are still popular for certain signal processing application. Now, in 1991, the next year, he was hired by Ericsson. And he was initially sent to Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, in their research center. And he was working on, of course, Ericsson was a mobile phone vendor. And then in 1993, he was transferred to Ericsson Mobile Terminal Division in Lund, Sweden. So he headed back there to Lund, Sweden. And he was tasked, when he got back to Sweden, with finding solutions for short-range radio connections to enrich mobile phone functionality. And by short range, it was like 3 meter to 4 meter. And one of the because Ericsson said, if we could like have a wireless connection, short range, we could do all kinds of things with it. But the key is it has to be cheap and it can't take much power. So it has to be low power consumption. And the cost of this chip or whatever it is has got to be less than $5. That was sort of their price bogey that they had at the time. Now, because the frequency band was actually shared by many consumer devices, they decided to operate in the unlicensed 2.4 gigahertz frequency band. And you've got like baby monitors and Wi-Fi, all kinds of stuff in that band. So you don't really know what's cooking. And so what they did in order to cope with interference that may be occurring in that band, they decided to use frequency hopping communication. Now, frequency hopping communication was really set up for secure communication, where you got two. That's kind of a sidebar, but that's okay.
No, go for it.
So you got you want to do secure communication, and so what you do is you hop around, and the sender and receiver know where you're hopping next, so they keep in lockstep. But if somebody's trying to listen in and they can't hop around with you, it just looks like noise.
Mm-hmm.
So spread spectrum is a very good way to engage in secure communication. So he thought, okay, we'll use frequency hopping technique, and then if there's an area frequency that's in use by the baby monitor, we just won't transmit on that frequency. So that made sense. Now, Dr. Hartson or Jopp, I don't think it's Jab. I think it's got to be Jopp. I'm going to call him Jopp.
Okay.
I like that better.
I'll go with that editorial decision.
Yeah. Now, if he, if anybody knows him personally, you can give him a call. Or we could call him Jacobus Cornelius, like his mother does. But I think Jopp.
I think Jopp is fine.
I think Jopp. Because the two A's, I think J-A-A-P, I would say Jopp. So he, Jopp decided to use this frequency, frequency hopping thing, and what he set it up where there would be 79 frequencies in the band, and they would actually hop around at the rate of 1600 times a second. So they're just doing a lot of hopping. Now, in the beginning, Jopp was working alone, and he was developing the standards, trying to get this thing going, trying to get some electronics, testing it out. But then they started building up a team because he actually created a workable model, workable electronics was actually transmitting and working. And in 1995, the next year he was joined by Sven Mattison. Now Sven became at that point really almost the co-project manager for the whole Bluetooth, and so he brought in Sven, and then they started adding more and more people because they had to build electronics, they had to build a chip, and then they had to have software on top, so they had a software team and a hardware team working together. Now, the name of their initial communication protocol was really something that marketeers loved. It was called Multi-Communicator Link, MCL. Multi-Communicator Link. I mean, doesn't that just kind of
It just tells you what exactly it is.
It just really just gives you that marketing pizzazz. Mm-hmm. Well, and so they were actually getting a lot of traction with this multi-communicator link. And so, but then by 1997, Ericsson realized that they'd better collaborate with other firms because it turned out that Nokia was working on a wireless, short-range wireless link. It turned out Intel was working on one. Toshiba was working on one. IBM was working on one. And it would be, from the consumer's point of view, a travesty if there were five standards out there.
Of course.
And there was no compatibility. So Ericsson decided to set up a special interest group, a SIG. So in 1998, they set up a special interest group, and there were five founding members. They had Ericsson and Nokia, which are very strongly competitive in the mobile phone business.
Mm-hmm.
They had Toshiba and IBM, which were very competitive in the laptop and computer business. And then they had Intel that wasn't competing with anybody. So it turned out, you see, Ericsson didn't trust Nokia, Toshiba didn't trust IBM. The only one that was on their own was Intel. So they decided to make Intel the leader of the SIG, because that's the only company that everybody could trust. So the lead person for Intel was Jim Kardec. Jim Kardec, he represented Intel. He's the one that suggested the name Bluetooth. So it turned out, you see, that because it turned out Jim Kardec loves history. And he had just finished a book about Sweden and some of the historical developments there. And there was a king, a 10th century Danish king named Harald Bluetooth. Bluetooth was his nickname.
How funny is this?
Harald Bluetooth. And Bluetooth was his nickname. It was really Harald Bluetooth Gormason. And he was the son of Gorm the Old. And his mother was Thyra Danabod. Now, he lived in the 10th century, and it turned out that he unified Denmark. And there were all these warring factions, and he brought the warring factions together to make a unified country. So what do we have here with this wireless technology? We got all these warring factors. We got Nokia, Ericsson, Intel, Toshiba, IBM, warring factors on warring groups on standards, and they thought we should bring them together and unify them under one flag. Well, what flag better than Bluetooth?
Why not?
In honor of Harald Bluetooth, the 10th century king. So that's kind of the reason why we had that. And so at that point, the special interest group said, okay, we're going to accept Bluetooth as our name. And so then it officially changed name to the Bluetooth SIG. Now, the first thing they did is they formed a patent pool for all the Bluetooth patents. It's because all these companies had, of course, were patenting their technology. So any patent that supported the standard that the group ultimately selected, and they basically went with the spread spectrum, the frequency hopping method that had been proposed by Jopp Hartson. And so they pulled all of their patents, and the deal was this. They said, look, if you use the standard, we'll license the patent to you without cost. Okay? So the patents were still owned by the companies, but they basically set an agreement where they could share the patents without cost. Now, this also gave them a certain amount of leverage that suppose there would be a rogue company out there that would try to set up a competing Bluetooth standards that and they didn't use them, they wouldn't license the patents to them, and so they felt this patent pool could keep rogue operators from operating, and it could sort of force everyone together. So that was the sort of how they organized it, and I think it was very done. And so they, once they had the patent pool put together, they defined a standard that they all agreed on, and all the patents that supported that standard were put into the pool. Then they licensed manufacturers to make Bluetooth devices according to the standards. And then when they made a device, they would test the device for compliance. Okay, that's what the SIG would do, the special interest group. And so, and it turned out Jopp was really instrumental in getting the thing going, but he wasn't the lead of it because they gave that to IBM for the political reasons. It turned out there were five patents filed by Dr. Hartson that were considered fundamental to the Bluetooth standard because it was based on his spread spectrum approach. So those were thrown into the pool. In addition to that, Hartson has also filed more than 200 other patents that weren't so central to the standard that they have. So this SIG patent pool was really essential to the early success of the technology. I sort of went through that because I think this method for companies to work together and pool their patents to get common standards make it so much easier for consumers instead of having these wars where, like, companies are suing each other and then you've got these competing standards and you don't know which one's going to win, say, like the power standards.
Sure.
And so for the consumer, when companies behave like adults, work together, and standardize and share their patents, it's just better for the world. So I thought I would highlight that.
That's pretty neat.
So in 1991, Bluetooth 1.0 was released. In the year 2000, okay, so the SIG was formed in 98, and they released the first standard in 1999. In 2000, a year later, the first mobile phones with Bluetooth appeared. And also that same year, we had Bluetooth PC cards, we had Bluetooth prototype mice, Bluetooth keyboards, Bluetooth USB dongles. All of that came out in 2000. In 2001, we saw Bluetooth printers, Bluetooth laptops, and we also saw the first Bluetooth car kits. See, it only took a couple of years once the standards were locked in. Mm-hmm. By 2011, the SIG had 15,000 member firms. So, you know, because everybody's doing Bluetooth of some variety or another. And by 2011, they had released Bluetooth version 4.0. So they'd gone on. So that's sort of so Jacobus, Cornelis, Hartson, he sort of led that whole thing done. And then in 2010, he decided to leave Ericsson because he'd been at Ericsson, after he developed all this stuff, then he started managing their portfolio of patents and he was doing licensing. And I think his job changed. And I think he said, I want to go back to my roots to technology. So he became chief technology officer of Tonalite in the Netherlands. And this is a company that creates wearable wireless products. Obviously, these are Bluetooth products. So then he started working on the consumer side to make Bluetooth-enabled products. So, it was sort of going back to his roots. He stayed there a couple of years, and then he was hired by Plantronics as a senior expert in wireless systems, and he's working for Plantronics now. So he sort of stayed with the whole wireless thing, but there you go, the man who is father of Bluetooth.
Pretty neat. Something that, I kind of took for granted up until now.
Jacobus Cornelis Hartson.
Now, I hope you're paying attention because you'll get a chance in just a moment to parlay that information, that knowledge, into a free prize from Tech Talk Radio when we play the pop quiz coming up here on 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Stand by. We'll be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to Classroom of the Airwaves. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if there is a classroom, there's going to have to be an assessment or a pop quiz. And if you get the correct answer to the pop quiz, you will win a grade of A-plus for the day. And you'll also
But that's not it.
You'll also get two tickets to fine dining, the Scoffier Dining Room or the Karem Dining Room. Now, earlier in the show, we were talking about Jacobus Cornelis Hartson, the father of Bluetooth.
Yes.
What was the name? This is the question now.
Right, yes.
Where did the name Bluetooth come from? And if you get the correct answer, just call in and you can win those fine tickets. Now, how can they reach us?
Well, that's a very good question, because if you're calling from west of the Hague, Netherlands, it's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from east of the university, the campus at Delft University of Technology, it's 877-936-9333. If that doesn't cover you anywhere else on the planet Earth, it's the wild card line, 877-936-9333. But I'm sure you have a more high-tech idea.
And if you are calling in from the Hague and you want to make certain that you're connection is encrypted, you can use Skype, and you simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1, and your call will be forwarded directly to the studio free of charge.
But I don't think you have to worry about that. It's just 877-936-9333.
No, you don't have to worry about that at all.
936-9333.
Well, the carriers are tracking you with super cookies.
Super cookies!
Super cookies. Now, researchers have found, for instance, that Verizon adds a 50-character unique identifier header on your web traffic when you visit any site. Now, that's if you surf with your cell phone. So they put this unique identifier, and so any place, anything you do with your cell phone, they track you. Now, the idea is that Verizon's advertisers can watch how your unique identifier header is used and where you're going and what you're up to, so they can serve you ads that are exactly what you want to see. And they say, they can track anything you do, and you can't get rid of that. Now, it turns out that AT&T, Sprint, and some Canadian carriers have admitted to having similar tracking systems, because these are not part of HTML. These are not cookies that go into your browser. These are actually part of the actual header that's put on by the cell phone, and you can't really get at it with the HTML. So they're called super cookies, because you can't get rid of, you know, a cookie you can delete. A super cookie you can't get rid of. So Verizon, when these were discovered, AT&T said, well, actually, we're only testing ours. We're not really using it. We're just testing it. And they said, oh, okay, AT&T. And they said, in fact, AT&T said, we will let you opt out. I think after it was discovered, we'll let you opt out. The nice thing with AT&T is if you opt out, it eliminates the super cookie number at all, so there's really no tracking. That's a nice thing to do. Now Verizon says, okay, we'll let you opt out. You just have to figure out how to do it. But when Verizon has you opt out, they do not delete your super cookie number.
Oh my!
So they can still be tracking you, but they just don't deliver ads to you based on that number. So you really have a privacy issue with Verizon, even though they say you opt out. And it's not very clear what they're going to do. Now, the way to avoid the super cookie is not to surf the web when you're on cellular data. Only surf the web when you're on Wi-Fi.
Ah.
And then you don't get the super cookie.
Oh, no kidding.
Because you're not using your cellular data connection, which is where the super cookie is inserted. So if you're using the Wi-Fi connection, no super cookie.
No super cookie for you.
No super cookie for you. That's right.
Very good. All right. Well, Doc, we have somebody on the phone who is going to play our little game with us here. Let's go to, if I can get this thing to work, there we go. We're going to go to line number one. This is Jose calling from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Jose. How are you, sir?
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Dr. Schertz, please ask the question.
Yes. Early in the show, we talked about Cornelius Hartson, the father of Bluetooth. And, of course, they set up this short-range communication protocol. Where did the name Bluetooth come from?
The name came from Danish King. I don't remember the first name, but his last name was Bluetooth.
Bluetooth.
Actually,
that is correct.
That's correct.
King of Denmark and Norway, Harald Bluetooth Gormason. Bluetooth was his nickname, and you know where the blue came from. He had a bad tooth, and blue was actually at that time meaning dark, so he probably had a dark decaying tooth, so they called him Bluetooth. Also, blue is a royal color. Since he's a king, his tooth should be blue.
There you go. And
very good.
Jose, thank you for listening. Thanks for calling in today. Hang on a second. We're going to hook you up with Andrew Mitchell, our adjunct professor, for keeping things above board here on Tech Talk Radio. This is indeed Tech Talk Radio, and you're listening to us every Saturday morning here on Tech Talk Radio on 1500 AM, 1077 FM HD2, and on federalnewsradio.com as well. You can find us there on the web. We'll be right back in just a moment.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. You know, the NSA has been revealing something that we've talked about here on Tech Talk quite often, is that the power grid can be shut down. They said China can do it, and they said they're investigating other countries that are doing it. And this has been a known threat for quite some time. NSA Director Michael Rogers said that Chinese cyber hackers can shut down the power grid in the U.S. China, and he said one or two other countries, are capable of launching cyber attacks that could terminate the ability of the power grid to function and shut down other critical systems nationwide. Now, this is there's a real possibility of a massive and devastating power grid cyber attack, and that's long been discussed by security experts. We actually talked about it on Tech Talk about, you know, a couple of years ago, I think. It's been around for a good long while. We've known about it. But this is the first time it's been officially confirmed by a top cyber official. Now, during the House Intelligence Committee hearing, NSA Director Michael Rogers said adversaries of the United States are currently engaging in electronic reconnaissance on a regular basis. Such activities are being conducted in order to ensure that China and other adversarial nations are in a position to disrupt the industrial control systems, such as power grids, enable food and medication delivery, and allow chemical facilities and water treatment plants to function. Non-government cyber experts appear to agree with Rogers and note that the U.S. Cyber Command has the ability to also hack into the grid of other nations. So what we have here, and what they were saying, is mutually assured destruction. And that's our only... So
it's the only protection, right?
Since we can bring down their power grid, they're not going to bring down ours because we'd retaliate and bring down theirs. It's sort of the old nuclear... Nuclear standoff of mutually assured destruction. So here's the interesting thing, though, is that what Rogers was saying is that we have to define what is an act of war. You see, right now, if they hack into our power grid and bring it down, that's technically, under the current rules of engagement, not an act of war. It's sort of an act of sabotage, but it's not. Now, if they'd come
interesting.
In, if they'd bombed the power grid,
that's a different story.
It's an act of war, and so the rules of engagement have not been updated to reflect this new cybersecurity threat. So. Rogers is saying that we need to set up a set of international principles that define this as an aggression, which is equivalent to an act of war, in which case you could go, you know, they bring down your power grid and you can just bomb them,
you know. And,
instead of just taking down their power grid. Now, it turns out that it's incredibly easy to find out how to get into the power grid.
You sure you want to go into this?
Yeah,
it's
all on the web, and it turns out employees are actually the weakest link when securing industrial control systems that run power plants, municipal settings. Andrew Whitaker, the director of the cyber attack penetration division of a company in Reston, was testifying, and he said. And he was explaining how he gets into power grids because he was doing penetration testing. And he said the objective is quite simple. You want to gain access, and they target they target SCADA engineers, S-C-A-D-A engineers. Now, SCADA stands for Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition, S-C-A-D-A, Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition. That's a device that links valves, switches, and other mechanical devices to the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you can get into the security of the SCADA device, you can actually flip a switch, turn a valve, open the floodgates on a dam. You can do all kinds of things because everybody wants these under internet controls. You can sit at home, log on. You can remotely monitor everything. It's a very nice way to do it remotely, but now we have this internet vulnerability. So they want to target SCADA, SCADA engineers. These are the guys that have all the passwords and know where they all are. So what they say, so how do we target these guys? Well, they ask them for their username and password.
Nice.
So what he does, Whitaker said, he crafts a simple, because these guys are like, you know, these guys are like working power grids or working, you know, dams. I mean, these guys are probably rough and tumble guys, and all this computer stuff has sort of been dumped on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got people that would rather be out in the field turning that valve with a wrench. And now they got to sit at a computer, and so they're
eating donuts and doing dumb stuff. And
yeah, and so what happened?
Like Homer Simpson.
So what happened is that Whitaker and his team they craft a simple phishing technique where they say something like this. They sent a brief email and they said, "It looks like it came from a staffer at the company's IT department." They'll say something like, "We made some changes to our web-based Outlook access. when you get a free minute, would you try logging on using your network credentials and let me know if you have any problems?" So they send this thing out, and of course the link goes to a fake Outlook page. This is what Whitaker said. In our experience, 18% of the employees give up their password when asked.
Yikes.
18%.
Jeez.
I mean, think about it. I mean, he said, we need is actually one or two to get in there. So the public's at large, and so it's basically, what the Chinese are sending out these phishing messages, and they're gathering passwords, and once they get into the net, so what they try to do is maintain their access to these SCADA devices, so when they want to do it, they can act. So they don't want to show their presence. Because if they show their presence, they'll be locked out. So they're constantly interrogating, probing, finding if they can get access. They want to keep access to these items. And so there's really no security that no amount of money can buy software that's going to fix this basic human frailty problem.
Sure.
And so, to that end, we got to make certain the companies are informed and educated to resist social engineering attacks. When they, you know, remember when they did that? They were in Iran. They had the centrifuge, and they were actually going in, and they had a malware device that was going in and controlling the centrifuges. It was going in there through some SCADA devices to do this, and so there. Some of these SCAD devices actually have security flaws in them. They might be password protected. They leave them with the default password. There's just a whole range of security issues. And since we've never had a major, you know, security breach that's actually brought stuff down, so people are just saying, well, it's probably okay. But actually it's not, and we've got to be mindful of that.
Interesting. Very interesting. Actually, Doc, let's take a break here for a second. This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Stand by. We shall return in just a moment.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business.
from writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge of Stratford University talking technology, but now we're talking lumps in your gravy.
Moving into the kitchen, actually.
Yeah, this is going to be gravy technology because, you know, we're getting close to Thanksgiving, and lumps in the gravy is really something you want to avoid.
Yes.
So, in order to talk about this, I want to talk about what something a basic principle of grain, say like wheat.
Mm-hmm.
Wheat has two parts. It's got the wheat germ, which is where all genetic material is from which the plant grows. Surrounding the wheat germ is the food that the seed uses when it's first growing, and the food that's around the wheat germ is actually starch. So every piece of grain has a small amount of protein, which is the wheat germ, surrounded by starch. And so starch is the action of what we have whenever we make lumpy gravy. By the way, there are different kinds of wheat. If the wheat has low amount of protein, say if it's a 6 or 7% protein, it's called soft wheat. And if you and soft wheat is used for making, say, cakes.
Mm-hmm.
If you use hard wheat, that might have 10% protein, and that's used for making bread.
Okay.
So if you have semolina, which is 14% protein, that's used for making pasta. So the amount of protein depends on how the amount of protein determines on what you make when you're baking. This is really aside from lumpy gravy.
Well, it's background.
So it's sort of background. And the other so it used to be you'd have bread flour, and then you'd have cake flour.
Mm-hmm.
And then people would say, well, you know, I don't like to have two flours. I just want one flour. So then they mixed soft and hard wheat, and so they make a flour that doesn't make a great bread and doesn't make a great cake, but it's okay for both of those. And that's called all-purpose flour. So that has like proteins about 8%.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cake flour, because whenever they grind up the protein, when you have the soft wheat, you grind it up, the protein grinds up in a very fine way. So if you put it between your fingers, it's very, well, it's soft as silk.
Sure.
So that's why they say the wheat flour, they call it soft as silk is one of the brand. And if you have bread flour, the protein is kind of coarse. So you can actually, a baker can sort of just put his fingers in the flour and he can feel it and he can tell how much protein is there. That's really just an aside. It's got nothing to do with lumpy gravy.
But no, it has a lot to do with it.
So let's talk about the starch.
Mm-hmm.
So the starch is really what makes things thicken up. So if you remove, say, from corn meal, if you remove the protein and you just are left with the starch, they call it corn starch.
Mm-hmm.
So you got corn starch, corn meal. If you remove the protein and you have the starch, and it's the starch that really gives you the thickening. So most sauces and gravies are thickened with some kind of starch. You could have flour, you could have corn starch, you could have potato starch, you could have arrowroot, tapioca flour, a lot of them, and all these have starches. It turns out that when you put starch in a liquid and heat it up between 130 and 160 degrees Fahrenheit, it turns into a gel. That's what happens, and the transition is really dramatic. You put flour and water, and when that reaches a certain point, all of a sudden, boom! You can see that gel forming,
mm-hmm.
And that transition is when the gravy gets thick. It's the gel that thickens the gravy. So the key to having gravy that isn't lumpy is managing the gelling process. So clearly, if you take hot liquid, you know, because your gravy is made with drippings from the meat plus water. And so if you heat it up and throw in the flour, globs of flour are going to get gel on the outside of them, and those are going to be lumps. So you got this. You got this gel. So you got these gel lumps. If you throw it in the hot liquid, so what you have to do is you've got to add your flour or your starch before it reaches that transition point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's completely mixed up and completely distributed.
Uh-huh.
So when you get to the 130-degree or 160-degree point, it thickens up, but there's no lump.
Interesting.
Because the lump is caused by the gel trapping untouched flour. And it's just encased in a gel, and it just sits there as a lump, and it just ruins your gravy.
No kidding.
Now, but here's the thing. Suppose that you heat up your gravy and it's not thick enough and you got to add more flour. What are you going to do? You can't cool it down.
Yeah, right.
No. So you use something called roux.
Aha!
Roux. So what you do is you take the flour and you mix it up with the oil or with butter.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could cook it if you want to have roux. So now all of a sudden the flour or the starch are dispersed in butter or grease. So now when you throw that in there, it doesn't lump because the grease melts and the flour is already dispersed. So you can add roux or you can add a flour ball while it's hot, as long as you mix it up right. So what I'll do, if I don't have a chance to make roux by heating it up and I got to thicken it up, I'll just get some butter, mix a little flour with it or some cornstarch, mix it up, get it all stirred up, and just throw a ball of that in there. No lumps.
No problem. So,
So that's all there is to it.
Well, you know, and the other thing is, another sidebar is there are different kinds of roux, right?
Yeah.
There's blonde roux, and it all depends on how long you cook it.
It's all kind of roux, and those roux give you different flavor depending. And so if you cook the roux, then it is already sort of expanded before you throw it in. And so the roux has a better flavor because the flour is cooked. If you throw in uncooked flour with butter, you put too much of it in, you got this floury taste.
Yep, exactly.
Now this is the deal. You want to add about 2 tablespoons of flour per cup of liquid. If you use cornstarch, because you're taking out all the protein, cornstarch, you only use 2 to 2.5 teaspoons per cup, about half as much if you're using cornstarch. So there you go. That is the science of gravy.
I'm taking this home with me because, you know, the funny thing is I wanted hot turkey sandwiches last weekend, right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And I made turkey, and then I threw the flour into the drippings from the turkey.
Yeah, and it was hot.
It was hot.
Yeah, and it was lumpy.
And
then
I'm trying to whisk it, and it's not working because, as you've just described, it's done once it's too
hot.
You were
stuck, yeah.
Interesting. So I will try this again, and I will make a roux instead.
Yeah, you can do the roux. That is the way to go.
So let me ask you this, because we're running out of time. Which is better for you, cornstarch or flour? Do you know what the answer to that is?
No.
Okay.
I usually, if I'm doing a stir fry, I'll thicken the stir fry with cornstarch.
Okay.
Because it's clear.
Okay.
Because like if you want kind of a clear thickened thing, the cornstarch is good.
Mm-hmm.
Or I say turkey gravy isn't clear. So this sort of the protein impurities in it, which make it not clear, don't matter.
Right.
But if you want a clear, thickened thing like you'd have in stir fry, then you use cornstarch.
Aha.
So I use cornstarch for stir fry, but then for gravy, I use flour.
We learned so much. We learned about Bluetooth and all that good stuff.
Listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu and go to the Stratford University website, which, of course, is stratford.edu, and let them know you heard about them on Tech Talk Radio.
And, of course, if you tuned in later, would like to hear this program again in its entirety, it'll replay tomorrow at 7 o'clock. See you next week on Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT-FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio on the air at 1500. 1400 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
We have hockey on the radio later on today. The Caps take on the Sabres, of course, here in D.C., 6:45 pregame, puck drops at 7. It's going to be sunny but cold today, high of 48 degrees right now inside our studios in Northwest. It is sunny and 49.